Well, I'm very pleased to be able to talk today with Toy Derricotte. She's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to talk about her work and to give a reading. This is part of the Carr series that brings writers and poets to the campus so that students can have an opportunity to talk with them and meet them, and so readers can do the same. And she'll be here, and we'll talk over the next hour or so about her work, and I'll ask her to read, and I'm just very pleased that you can be here.
Thank you, David.
And talk with us. You know, over time, I've been fortunate to be able to talk with a lot of writers.
Sure.
And people who have come to the campus, people who do prose and people who do poetry. And to me, poetry has always been a mystery,
mm-hmm.
a great mystery, and I'm never really quite sure how to talk about it,
mm-hmm.
what sort of questions to ask.
Right.
What is it? For you, what is it that attracts you to poetry?
Well, you know, I write prose, so-called prose and poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I have a book of memoir.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never thought when I started writing that I was writing in any particular form. I started writing when I was probably 8 years old. And you know, I wasn't thinking to myself, oh, today I'm going to sit down and write a poem. And I really don't think that way now. Sometimes I talk about my prose as I didn't sit down to write prose. I just sat down and started writing, and the line kept going.
Hmm.
And I think for me, there's some sort of interior form that kind of knows more about itself than you know. And the voice is coming from a place that you're not necessarily in control of. Of course, it takes many, many years to learn how to put some, guides along that voice to know how to have a little bit of control over it in certain ways. You don't want to have too much control. But so I really think of writing coming probably from the same source. In fact, I think a lot of creativity comes from the same source, and that we shape it in different ways. And so I think for me, I felt a certain need for compression in what I was saying. Making something real. When I was like 3 years old, I used to draw things, and I thought they were real. I'd draw a car, and I thought I had a real car. I was probably 2 or 3 years old. And my intent is to make something real, to create an object. And it's a way of taking something that's internally disordered and chaotic and confusing and maybe anxiety producing and creating something outside of myself that has form. And so I just do that in a way that feels most capable, maybe, of making that transfer happen. And a lot of that is an internal thing that moves me in that direction.
Yeah. Sometimes I wonder whether people don't think about poetry, writing a poem is something like being hit by lightning, you know, that it's something that happens to you,
uh-huh.
and then it spills out, and
uh-huh.
don't understand that while something like that may be going on, that you do a lot of wrestling with it to get it right on the page.
Oh, yeah.
And that it's something that you have to work at, that it's not something that just happens.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, there's most of my books take 20 years to write. I have about 6 books, and two of them were written consecutively, but the Black Notebooks, I started it in probably 1973, and I published it in 1998. And for me, a book is, it's not only about the content, it's about form and how do you make how do you create the right form for the content so that it presents itself in the way you want it to be read? So that you might have an enormous amount of content. I mean, I had so many boxes of things I had written that were content for the Black Notebooks. But in the end, you know, out of thousands and thousands and thousands of pages, I kid you not, you know, this is a 150 or 200 page book. And it's not, it's about learning form. It's about deciding what kind of form. Like, for, I mean, the Black Notebooks as at one time was a poem. It was a long poem. And then I understood that because it's poetry, poetry sort of makes the reader take a step back and look at it as an object. You know, oh, it's a piece of art. And, you know, but I didn't want that effect for the Black Notebooks. I wanted the reader to just enter into it as if it was my journal, you know, very personal writing. And in fact, people say to me, oh, you know, that was like, you know, so just like reading your journal. I mean, and they might think that I just sat down and wrote that, you know, and it turned out that way. But people who know, you know that it doesn't just happen that way. So you make conscious decisions about how you want, how the effect you want, and how to get that effect. But I'll tell you, there is something to the lightning theory, because in a way, I think the job of the writer and the poet is to pay attention to what is going on inside, and recognize when the poem is coming or when it is there. My dear friend, the poet Ruth Stone, who just died a couple months ago, she was 95 when she died. She would tell me, you know, put your hand up and catch them when they go by, because they don't belong to you. If you don't catch them, they go on to the next one. So I think writing is always a paradox. There's always two things going on at the same time, at least. And one is an openness to what's there, and the other is about control. And one is not more important than the other.
Hmm. I'm talking this morning with Toy Derricott. She teaches English. She's professor of English at University of Pittsburgh, has published several collections of poetry. The most recent is The Undertaker's Daughter. She also has this memoir that she's talked a little bit about, The Black Notebooks, and she's won a number of awards for her work, including two Pushcart Prizes. She's visiting the campus to talk to students and to give a reading, and we're pleased that she could be spending some time with us. Now, we're recording this interview, so that means we'll not be taking calls as we usually do. Would you, at this point, would you like to read something so people will have an opportunity to hear you?
Yeah, sure, sure, sure. Just the other day, someone was putting this poem on a broadside, and I hadn't read it in a long time. This is from a book that was published in 89, and the book is called Captivity, and in it I start to dig into issues about class and race and color, and that was the first time I had sort of begun to dig into this material in my poetry. So, but anyway, I was teaching at a school. I taught in the Poets in the School program for 15 years, and I'd go to schools for 4 days and get the kids to write poems. And then on the last day, I'd say to the kids, okay, you've been writing poems for 4 days. What is a poem? And I remember this one little kid said, oh, Toy, I don't know what a poem is, but it makes you shut up. And that just seemed so right to me, because an audience does get really quiet. There is a silence when a poem is coming. And so I loved my teaching there. And one day I had asked them to write about animals, and I would write with them because it just made them feel easy. If the teacher is writing too, and I'm going to read my poem the same time they read theirs, and mine usually is not as good as theirs, by the way. But also... I was living in New Jersey, and I was living just a few miles from William Carlos Williams' house, the poet. And he was sort of my poetry father. Of course, I'd never met him, but his work meant that much to me. And I used to go and sit in front of his house. He was dead, but his son still was. He was a doctor, and he still practiced in the same place where there was an office and a home. And I'd just sit there, and I'd imagine William Carlos Williams up there on the attic. I'd look at the attic, and I'd imagine him writing his poems. And then after I would go walking, there is the second tallest falls in North America is in Paterson, New Jersey. I know, it's weird. I know, nobody.
In New Jersey.
I know, nobody knows it. It's called the Paterson Falls. And it's a narrow falls, but very deep. And there's a narrow bridge. And sometimes I'd walk over it. So that was on my mind when I asked the children to write about animals. And I wrote this poem. Boy at the Paterson Falls. I am thinking of that boy who bragged about the day he threw a dog over and watched it struggle to stay upright all the way down. I am thinking of that rotting carcass on the rocks, and the child with such power he could call to a helpless thing as if he were its friend, capture it, and think of the cruelest punishment. It must have answered some need, some silent screaming in a closet, a motherless call when night came crashing. It must have satisfied, for he seemed joyful, proud, as if he had once made a great creation out of murder. That body on the rocks, its sharp angles, slowly took the shape of what was underneath. Bones pounded until it lay on the bottom like a scraggly rug. Nothing remains but memory. And the suffering of those who would walk into the soft hands of a killer for a crumb of bread.
How is it that that can be both beautiful and really disturbing at the same time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a paradox. And again, for me, the poet's job is to show what's human, to show what it's like to be human. And sometimes we have to go through layers of inhibition or repression, you know, in our society. What are the things that we're supposed to think about? What are we supposed to talk about? What self are we to present to the world? Does it have to be a smiling self? Does it have to always bring good news? I mean, there are these pressures, and yet it's so very important to recognize what's obvious, that there are children who in this world we live in have suffered, have been harmed, and do harm because that's what they've learned. Mm-hmm. And just as I was reading the poem, I think this sums up a lot of what my work is about. I hadn't thought about this before, but I say, as if he had once made a great creation out of murder. And I really think almost all of my work, and I'm just sitting here realizing it now, is about making creation that could have been something terrible to make it into something beautiful. And not only for me, but in my teaching and in my outlook about what art does. It's about taking what could destroy oneself and others and turning it into something beautiful.
I'm reminded of this detail that I read about you when you were a teenager, and the first time that you showed some of your poetry to someone, and I think it was a cousin, and the story was that the cousin found it disturbing,
right.
And your conclusion was, well, either I could just stop writing, mm-hmm. or I could continue write and just keep it to myself and not show anybody. And apparently your decision was, well, you couldn't not write, so you kept
on. Well, also, I could have done another thing. I could have written what I knew he wanted me to write, because I know what he wanted me to write. So I could have done that. But I don't want to do that. And I didn't even then. And it's sort of interesting because I knew already when that must have happened when I was 13 or 14 years old. I knew that this is a part of myself, and I think it's a part of others, that has to be protected. And that one has to figure out where one is safe to be, to bring this most valuable power. It's a very powerful thing to write. To create is a very powerful thing. And I think everyone has this ability. But sometimes that part of yourself gets harmed, and you withdraw, or you just think, oh, I'm not really that good, you know, and you just sort of kill it. So I'm obviously somebody who wants that not to happen.
Yeah.
Well, even if you have to hide, it's okay to hide for a while. You know, just know you have something very powerful, a gift.
The story that comes out of the fact that you were working in school and you were working with kids. And,
right.
And it also makes me think about how it seems that poetry is something that children take to really easily. They don't have to be prodded, and that as we go along and we get older, it seems more foreign or more odd. And I don't know if it's just that children are less inhibited, or maybe it says something about poetry just actually being a natural thing, kind of like singing. It just kind of happens in a sense, and that we lose that, so that later it becomes strange and foreign and artificial, and we don't really know how to do it, and we don't know how to read it, and
I think we're educated out of being in touch with that unique and singular aspect of our own beings that is there. I mean, I think even adults, even people who are afraid to write, well, usually people who are afraid to write have been told that they can't write, that they did it wrong, they're not that good, or that's the voice they're listening to in their own head. But I think if people feel they're in a place where they can speak about things that really matter to them and can have an opportunity to talk about what's important to them, what memories shaped them, what they love, what they hate, these things, people want to talk about these things. And even people who are not, didn't get a college degree in writing or learn how to spell or punctuate, you don't have to have these things to have something inside that wants to express what's important. And I think that has the same value in every human being. Some of us go on to be poets and publish books, and some don't. But it doesn't mean that's not important.
You started journaling when you were how old, 11?
I started journaling probably when I was, 10 or 11.
Yeah. What was it you were writing about?
You know, I think I was just writing about these ideas that came to me that I couldn't talk to anybody about. I was an only child, and I didn't grow up in the kind of home that where, your parents are like so fascinated by everything you do, you know, and then you do something, you say, oh, that's so wonderful. You know, I grew up in a home where people were very busy working and, you know, had hard jobs, and they came home tired and frustrated sometimes, often. And, you know, I sort of had to play by myself, so to speak. And I was, it was great that I had that. That kind of solitude, in a way. And I think my writing came out of that.
So when you were a little girl, did the idea that you would grow up and become a poet and a writer and a college professor, did that ever even enter into your head?
You know, I don't think that idea even anyone had at that time. I mean, I knew I was going to go to college. I mean, never was a question for me. I just knew that would happen, but by the way, then tuition was $200 a semester, right? I say that I'm a poet when I'm writing a poem. Basho said that a poet is a person who writes one poem. When you put a sheet of paper down, who knows what is going to come or not come? You know, great poets have told me, oh, I haven't written a poem in 7 years. So anyway, I didn't ever think that. And it's something that probably I could say about myself now that I'm a poet. But for many, many years, I wasn't too convinced of that.
Was there... Could you point to some point where you would say, aha, on this day, I said to myself,
no.
Toy, you're now a poet.
You know,
poet.
I think for me, there's some inner fear of claiming something for myself. It's not that I wasn't writing. It's not that I didn't obviously passionately love what I was doing, but how could I claim that for myself? I don't know. That's sort of like, I wonder if sometimes the things that we want the most in our lives are the most difficult for us to claim.
Does it, as you were going through the process of making something, and then and I don't know if you ever really have the feeling that it's done, but...
Oh, I do.
You do. You get to the point where you say, all right, this is done.
Oh, yeah.
It's printed on a piece of paper. I have it sitting in front of me.
Yeah.
This is it.
Yeah, after 20 years sometimes. A lot.
So what it... After having gone all through the process and then getting it out and getting it down and having it on the paper and it's sitting in front of you and it's done...
Right.
When you look at it, what does that give you? Satisfaction, feeling of accomplishment?
Fabulous. It's fabulous. It does. It's the click of the box. Boom. Everything. You know, after struggling with form and content for many, many years, suddenly you know it's right. It's done. And it's like a click of a box. It's instantaneous. As long as you work at it, it doesn't happen until it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great relief, and it's like an obsession just disappears. Something that's really preoccupied you for years suddenly just disappears, like a weight off your shoulder. It's done. It really happens like that.
And if no one ever read it, would it be okay?
It's still done. It's done. I did it.
See, so I guess I'm interested in understanding more why you're doing it. So clearly, you're doing it for yourself.
I've heard it said that a poem is, you know, that the last line of a poem is a surprise. I mean, that's what makes a poem interesting. If you're writing a poem and you know what's going to happen all the way through, You know, I had a nice day. It was beautiful. And then everybody loved each other. You know, if there's no surprise, it's not a poem. Something has to happen that turns you in an unexpected way so that it makes you see something in a fresh way. You know, it's that old idea of looking at the same thing but suddenly seeing it for the first time. And I think that's what a poem should make us do. And I think a book is the same. I think that it's sort of like a whole book is like the last line of a poem. When you put it together as a whole thing, when it just kind of clicks in place and boom, there's a new way to think about something, then the book is finished for me. But it has to be very clear, and that's what takes time, to clear away the stuff that is distracting or causes you to go in the wrong direction, the reader to go in the wrong direction, or just bores you, you know, like, oh, so you didn't you just say this 3 pages ago? You know, I tell my students, go by the mafia principle. If say it once and say it and powerfully as you can. If you have to say it twice, they know you're not serious. So you have to really find that way of saying something that is powerful and makes the reader pay attention because they know, hey, okay, she's going to tell me this one time, so I better keep my mind going, watching right now. Yeah. I can't doze off.
That's, I guess, and you know, if I've asked people what attracts them to writing poetry, it seems to be something like that, the idea that you're taking some thought or some idea or some experience and you're distilling it to the essence.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, though, that, you know, I talked at the beginning about feeling that it was sort of mysterious. Maybe that's also where some of the mystery lies, because it's not always, because you may indeed be still distilling something down to its essence, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're making it clear.
I don't know. You know, there's all different kinds of poets and poetry, and I guess for me, my way is to make clear. It doesn't mean it's the only way or the best way, but it's what I learned. It's part of the generation of poets that I that were mentors to me. And it comes out of my need at a particular time, place in our culture. But, of course, things constantly change. That's why writing keeps alive and keeps being open to what's going on now. I mean, children who grow up with computers and iPads and, you know, they're going to be thinking about language in a very different way than I did.
The guest here this morning in this hour of focus is Toy Derricotte. She is professor of English at University of Pittsburgh. She has published several collections of poetry. She has a memoir, The Black Notebooks, and her most recent collection of poems, The Undertaker's Daughter. She's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois and here to talk with students and is here for a reading. And we're recording this interview, so that means in this hour we're not taking calls. Would you like to read something else?
Yeah, I'll read something I wrote just last week. I was driving down Penn Avenue in Pittsburgh, and there's a section, a wholesale section called The Strip, that's just these food warehouses, one after the other, but you can shop in some of them, you know, and they have very fresh kinds of things. So people make pilgrimages down to the Strip on Saturday morning to get their cheeses and whatever. But it's not a nature place at all, you wouldn't say. So I was just driving down the street and I looked and lo and behold was this thing that I wrote about. And this is sort of maybe like you were talking about a glimpse or a moment of illumination. Uh-huh. And so that's what happened. For the young cherry tree on Penn Avenue in the Strip. Maybe it's the littlest ones that blossom first. their heat so close to the skin, their little hearts so hot, so yearning. So that at evening rush hour, on my way home through the strip, why should I be surprised to see that cherry, not as tall as my head, in pink flames? She is the first to throw off winter rags. You can see the joy rising, the straight proclamation through concrete. I am here. Let me make you happy. In the morning, when I lift the blinds, I search the top of that old cherry in my yard. Has she heard? But there is not yet a wink of courage.
Well, that's very nice. It does indeed make me think about times when either I've talked to people with their writing or I've looked at something and had maybe at least an idea of what kind of experience might have inspired it, and feeling that maybe I've had an experience kind of like that, but it didn't register with me. I just passed on by. I mean,
it
has something to do with
that's right,
being present and
right,
paying attention.
It did register.
Yeah.
It did register, and it's in there. But things just got piled on top of it. And that's what I try to help my students to do, to re-remember what they glimpsed that they lost. And just to be awake and know when the gift is given to you, and to respect it, you know. And so that's one of the things I like to try to get my students to pay attention to.
Hmm. It's something, this is different. This is going off on an angle, but it's something that I really wanted to ask you about. And I mentioned a couple of times that the most recent collection of poems is titled The Undertaker's Daughter. The thing that I really had to ask you about was, I read that growing up, your grandparents ran a funeral home?
Yeah, sure.
And that you actually, you spent time there around the funeral home?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As you spend there, you know, the funeral parlor was on the first floor, and they lived on the second floor. And I'd, of course, spend the night there all the time. Actually, one of my jobs was to answer the phone in the undertaking parlor. And, you know, when you grow up around something, it's, you know, it was certainly a bit disturbing for me, but you know, when you grow up with something, that's just the way it is. You don't really ask too many questions about it.
What can you think of particular experiences that stand out in your mind as either you're being disturbing or just being important?
Oh, there's
important,
so many. You know, I think of lining up the chairs, pulling out the wooden chairs, and setting them up, and you know, being aware, would it be a big crowd there or not many? And the flower, they used to have hearses, flower cars, they'd call them. And I just think of the big black flower cars with all of the gladiolas and roses and all, you know, just like, you know, a huge basket just brimming with flowers, and following that to the grave. And some things I think I maybe imagined, you know, some things that are real. I remember little things, sitting in the office, you know, answering the phone and being so proud of myself that I could, you know, I must have been like 5 or 6 years old, you know. And that was a time, by the way, when kids had jobs. You know, I had a job since the time I was like 3 years old. I had stuff I had to do. And that was good, too, because I was proud of myself, you know, when I could help other people. And sometimes I got paid. I like that, too. And I remember sad things. I remember the times a baby would die. And I'd be very curious about that. So
I'm sure that would be, you know, for people who do that, who are in that business, death is a part of daily life. Right. And I'm sure that it you end up thinking differently about it, maybe being less. I don't know if it's possible to be less emotional about it, or are you just you more accepting of the fact that that is a part of life and that what you're doing is you're just trying to help people through that.
Well, I think certainly, you know, maybe at the base of our creative instinct is an opposition to death. You know, maybe that's why we create, because we don't want to lose things. We don't want things to go away forever. And I think people have said that about poetry, that poetry is an act of memory, and that any act of memory, in fact, is a tribute to what it is to be alive. And so that whatever you write about, and however you write about it, if you write in an angry way about something that happened to you, it's still a tribute. It's still trying to oppose what is lost. And so maybe that does have its basis in my early awareness that things are lost, things are left behind. And it maybe it is a pretty scary thing to realize.
Is there now? I'm putting you on the spot now, but is there something that you
not that
might,
you haven't been putting me on the spot for the last?
Oh, we never do that. No, we don't do that with people.
Thanks
we don't
a lot.
Do that with people.
I'm scared now. I'm really scared.
See, I should never. You should never preface a question by that, because it gets people even more upset. All I was going to say was I wondered if there was some might be something that you could read that would show that kind of inspiration. That's why, because I don't know how difficult it would be to think of something, or whether you would have something like.
Oh, I'm sure I do. I'm just trying to think of what might be.
I'm just going to have to make some notes about stuff never to do again in any case.
Well, you know, I think now that you're bringing that up, I think anything in here is sort of touched with that behind it. Let's see from the new book. I mean, even a little poem like this, it's called A Little Prayer to Our Lady. And I can see behind this, way, way behind it. Like a palimpsest, like you look mm-hmm. through the layers and there's stuff under it. And I can see under this sort of a longing for something sacred that is kind of brings about a sense of safety and protection. And then I can say under that is maybe a disturbing fear of being lost or being forgotten. So here, a little prayer to Our Lady. So all day I go by the Christmas tree bulb, orange, in the little altar of shells that I set up and keep lit at the top of the stairs, so that rising now I rise to praise her, to remember the sacredness of my work. Perhaps she likes orange light thrown softly against her, for she looks divine. My house seems richer, more alive, less lonely with her here. I am allowed to believe.
Maybe one more time here, for anybody who's just tuned in, I should say that you are listening to Toy Derricott. She is professor of English at University of Pittsburgh. She's a poet. She has published a number of collections of poetry, and her most recent is The Undertaker's Daughter. She has several others. Also, the memoir that we talked about, The Black Notebooks, and she's visiting the campus, and I'm really pleased to be able to
talk
with you.
Thank you, David.
Tell me about Kaveh Khanum. And
Kaveh
how it
Khanum.
Is
oh,
you
yeah.
came to this is I did not mention this is a workshop and retreat for African American poets that you
right.
co-founded.
Right. And certainly I think that comes a lot out of this urgency for what is hidden, that creative part of the self that is hidden and buried and repressed for it to come forth. I am an African-American poet and writer, and you know, I never read another African-American poet in grade school or high school or college or graduate school. And I remember asking one of my graduate professors why I had never read an African-American poet in graduate school. And he said, "We don't go down that low."
Oh.
I know. And, you know, the only reason I got to hear that is because people don't recognize me as a black woman, you know, and people think I'm white, or else I wouldn't have heard that. But that has a devastating effect. But it, I think, you know, if you really go back to slavery and the idea that it was against the law, not only for black people to write, but for anyone to teach black people to write. You know, that fear that they would write their own, you know, passage out of slavery, which a lot of people did. You know, they wrote a pass and they were, you know, they said their master wrote it and they were gone. But I think that that idea has become, somehow was deeply, that fear was in me that maybe I wasn't capable of being a poet. Maybe I wasn't smart enough. Why didn't I read African American poets? And here was this drive inside me to be a poet. And then there was this kind of situation in creates another kind of situation in which if you are a black poet, you end up sort of fighting with yourself or another black poet, which is, what is a black poet? Oh, okay, if you're a black poet, you have to write about race. You know, you're not really a black poet unless you write about race. And or, and then the other one says, oh, no, you're not a poet if you're writing about race, because race isn't really a poetic subject. It's not universal. So therefore, you're not a poet. So this kind of way in which this racism really tore the community apart, and so I was always the only teacher. I was always the only professor. I was always the only student. And then I started meeting a few others, and one was a dear friend, Cornelius Eady, and his wife Sarah Micklem. And I had had a desire for many years to have a place where African American poets could gather and see each other, just know there were others out there. And I asked them if they wanted to do this with me, and they said, oh, yeah, sure. And I said, where are we going to get the money? And Sarah said, oh, let's just do it out of our own pockets. And I had a friend who was a priest who was a director of a monastery on the Hudson River who I called instantly, and he said, oh, come on up and use the monastery. And the next year we had 30 African-American poets from all over the country, and that was 16 years ago. We have 350 poets who have been through a three-year program, who have a very powerful community. They've won the top awards in the country. Just a couple weeks ago, one of our faculty won the National Book Award, Nikki Finney. Another faculty won the Pulitzer Prize a few years ago. One of my graduate assistants who helped me start the thing won the National Book Award, Terrence Hayes. So they're getting the top awards, but the main thing is they sit in a circle and they see they're not alone and they're safe. They don't have to write about race. They don't have to not write about race. And there's just a great power and freedom in that that's been released.
Yeah. For you personally, as a matter of identity and self-definition, how does race come into it?
Well, I certainly spent 20 years exploring that and read the Black Notebooks.
That is the issue, and we're at the point where
well, I'm not going to be able to talk about
that. We can't really talk about that.
It's a big deal. It's a big part of identity, not because, you know, it's about responding to something that is very real in our society. And race is very real in our society.
And it seems that as time goes along, we don't get any better at being able to talk about it.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I certainly, one of the things I do is with students and even with audiences, I bring a situation that helps make it easier to talk about and sort of give people a chance to not be afraid. I mean, that's the whole thing, isn't it? That people are afraid to really say who they are. And so I like to help people not to be afraid to do that because, you know what? We're not so ugly underneath or dangerous, and I think the more free we are, the better we can really accept each other for who we are as individuals.
We're just about at the point we have to stop. Would you read maybe one more poem?
Okay, all right. Since we've been talking about race, I think I'll read this one from the new book about my mother and dad being light-skinned and being part of a middle-class and upper-middle-class group of people in Detroit in the early 40s, some of whom passed, that is, went places and took jobs without people knowing they were black, and what that felt like. Some passed and some didn't. Sunday afternoon at Claire Carlisle's. My mother and father, light-skinned, but too new to make the upper cut, were nevertheless welcomed into the marble foyer under an icebox-sized chandelier to mix martinis with double-edged men and women trained to outwit and outwhite the whites. Almost all were light and straight-featured enough to pass. Some did, some didn't. Claire's brother Bob passed. If seen weekdays, he wasn't to be spoken to. Light and dark did the same, an inward move to protect those fortunate enough to choose. But why did my mother, who looked as white as Loretta Young, see Bob one weekday walking toward her up Woodward Avenue and cross the street to the other side? Why, when anyone would only have seen two white people? It was something in my mother not visible. In her mind's eye, she was black, and wore the robe of it over her fine features. Perhaps she crossed in case some inner misstep might betray him, the inner world being vast and treacherous. As if they were slaves running for their lives.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. If you'd like to read more from our guest, Toy Derricotte, you might look at her most recent collection, The Undertaker's Daughter, or The Black Notebook. She's professor of English at University of Pittsburgh.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much for being here.
All right.